Welcome to Heard at Heritage. Heard at Heritage features cutting-edge analysis and thought from leading experts in and across the conservative movement, as well as premier events and programming from the Heritage Foundation here in the heart of Washington, D.C., brought straight to you.
Hello, and welcome back to the Power Hour, the Heritage Foundation Center for Energy, Climate, and Environment's podcast. I'm your host, Jack Spencer, and I am thrilled to have back in the saddle today, back with us for the first time in a while, the one, the only, the chief propagandist of the Power Hour, Mr. John Pop. John, how are you today?
I am wonderful. I'm proud to be back as the chief propagandist. I love it.
All right. What have you been up to, man, on the mend?
I've been up to about 6 feet.
All right, very good.
That's such an old joke. I'm sorry.
That seems about where you were when I last saw you,
That's right. All
seems to be as it should be.
I am on the mend, feeling good, and glad to be back in the saddle.
Now, here's the one thing I'm really disappointed about. I don't know if you recall this, but the last time we talked, I was in the middle of my pallet projects, and I had built a spice rack that I was very proud of, and a cabinet. I said to you, what should I build with my remaining wood? And you said an end table.
Yes.
And John Pop, I built an end table, and it's the most beautiful thing. It has two pieces. I wanted to send you a picture of it so we could discuss it for everyone, how good of a craftsman I am.
Wait.
But I didn't get a chance yet.
How does an end table have two pieces?
Oh, wouldn't you like to know? You will know. I'll describe it to you quickly.
Okay.
It's the end table, and then I made a thing that sets on top of it that's like a serving tray.
Very nice. It's
a serving tray / end table.
Wow.
I made all of those things out of two pallets.
Wow, that is nice.
So when the apocalypse comes,
yes,
I'll not only be able to shoot deer but serve my venison on a table with a platter. So there you go.
A fancy end table made out of a pallet. That is
brilliant. So there you go. I'll send you a picture of it. I'm sure people want to hear what we think about it in the next episode of the Power Hour.
Absolutely.
All right. So some things haven't changed. We still have housekeeping to do, which consists primarily of reminding people of what our email address is. It's thepowerhour@heritage.org. That's thepowerhour@heritage.org.
Yep. Send those emails. Come on.
And John, I don't know if you know this, but our last guest was emerged out of an email exchange I had with a listener.
So we had someone
come and talk to us about a fight she was engaged in out in Idaho to keep the big green industrial complex off of our unmolested federal lands. So anyway, that's a great podcast. I hope folks enjoyed that. Now, John, do you remember where people can find us? Can you bring that back to the table? Because frankly, I'm tired of doing it.
Do I remember? Look for Heard at Heritage, the Power Hour. Heard at Heritage, the Power Hour. You can get us wherever you can get podcasts. Apple, Spotify, Ricochet, you name it, we are there. And please subscribe and share.
Yeah, that way you don't have to go through that whole process of finding us. We'll just like show up in your inbox or wherever podcasts show up.
Yeah, great stuff on that feed as well. So please, Heard at Heritage, the Power Hour.
Now, John, we have got a good one today.
I promise
you that. Now, let me ask you something.
Go.
You know when people are talking about renewable energy or green energy?
Yeah.
They'll often talk about it in terms of a race. They'll say things like, the U.S. needs to win the clean energy race.
Yeah.
A recent Reuters article was headlined, I was looking at this morning, clean energy race sparks more ambitious climate policies. Or worse, we pit ourselves against China. We need to spend your taxpayer money, lest China wins the clean energy race. Oh my, nobody wants that. We got to beat the Chinese in the clean energy race.
That's right.
Well, you know what's going on here. This is high-level marketing. Or I should probably more accurately characterize it as good old-fashioned propaganda. It's classic. You get special interest pulling at the heartstrings, or in this case, our patriotism, to fool us into supporting things that, by all accounts, are bad for us, if not downright stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how could we not only support policies that take away the literal lifeblood of our economy, the stuff that has literally lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, and replace it with something that specifically makes us poorer, will decrease our standard of living, will lead to shorter lives, less democracy, and more centralized power. Yet that is precisely what we're doing when we allow the bureaucrats, politicians, and special interests to replace clean, abundant, and affordable coal. Yes, I said it, clean coal, gas and oil, stupid windmills. I would even say polluting solar panels and whatever else they're cooking up. We're falling for it, John. We are falling for it. Worst of all, John, they've convinced us to pay for it with our own money.
Ugh.
We pay through higher taxes. We pay through higher prices. You know, a lot of folks scoffed when Trump said he was going to make Mexico pay for the wall. That is chump change compared to what these guys have convinced us to pay for through their green energy policies. Yeah, here we are falling for their propaganda. Now, luckily, I suppose, the United States is not winning this race yet. At least we're not in the lead. Other countries started earlier and are further into it than we are. And we need to learn from them. And guess what, John? Something else has not changed about the Power Hour.
What?
We just happen to have with us today the best person in the world to tell us about that.
Of course.
A senior fellow from the Real Clear Foundation. This person's an expert on energy policy, finance, and economics. He taught economics and history at Cambridge University, the Cambridge, the fancy one. I'm guessing it's the fancy one. He made a living in finance and investment, so he's not just one of these ivory tower guys. He's lived the life and walked the walk. He was even a special advisor to United Kingdom's Chancellor of the Exchequer. Now, most of us don't know what that means, but I'm told it's an important position. So we're going to ask him about that specifically.
No idea.
Most important of all, though, at least for us today, is that he's a prolific author, writing for distinguished publications like the Wall Street Journal, National Review, and the Daily Telegraph. Oh, and he writes books with titles like The Age of Global Warming, A History, and probably my favorite title of any book ever in the history of mankind since Wealth of Nations, Green Tyranny, Exposing the Totalitarian Roots of the Climate Industrial Complex. And finally, he's the author of a new report called The Folly of Climate Leadership, Net Zero and Britain's Disastrous Energy Policies. Coming in hot from the United Kingdom, I present to the Power Hour audience my friend, Rupert Darwall. Rupert, welcome to the Power Hour.
Thrilled to be joining you, Jack.
It's so great to have you here. Now, I also have to say, we have a late addition to the podcast, and I'm not going to give him the big introduction because he's had it twice. You only get it twice on the Power Hour. We also have with us my colleague and my friend and Power Hour alum, regular now, Mario Loyola. Mario, welcome back to the Power Hour.
Great to be with you.
All right. So there we go, John. What do you think of that?
I think that is a power-packed Power Hour panel.
All right, there we go. Now we're going to get into it after all that, Rupert. Seriously, thank you for being here. I'm looking really forward to this conversation. The first thing we always like to do is introduce our guest to our audience a little bit. Let us know who Rupert Darwall is. How did you get involved in this? I mean, you've done a million things. How do you get involved in the climate debate and where you are now?
Yeah, let me tell you. So I should just correct one thing that you said. I was taught history and economics rather than at Cambridge. I didn't actually teach it to anyone else. But that experience, having studied economics.
I apologize for that.
Having studied economics at Cambridge, which actually was near enough a total waste of time because they're complete hyper-Keynesians, liberals and all that kind of stuff, kind of like a mini Harvard in that respect. There was this really brilliant economist who did a radio show, the Reith Lectures, which are a really prestigious series of lectures put on by the BBC. And it was given by a chap called David Henderson, who was the chief economist of the OECD. And about two decades later, I was at a think tank in Britain, in London. And I sat next to him, and I really wanted to meet him because this guy talks sense as economics, not the economics I was taught, but the economics I wanted to learn. And we got on really, really well. And he kind of started winding me up about things like the triple bottom line, you know, all about the triple bottom line and sustainability and all that stuff. And he'd wind me up. And then we got on to climate change and global warming. And it got to such a pitch. This guy was really clever. He wound me up so much, he forced me to write a book, really is therapy. You know, when you're sort of really kind of a worked up with an issue, actually my advice to your listeners is write a book, write it down on a piece of paper and you'll feel a lot better. And so that's how my first book came about. the history, the age of global warming history. So that's what. So that's how I really got into all this. It was an accident. It's not that that I sought it out. It sought me out, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Now, did you write that book soon after college?
No, that was.
You had a career.
Yeah, I had a career there. So I worked briefly at the Treasury, as you said, as a special advisor to the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Actually, at the time of the Rio Earth Summit, where the takeaway for the Treasury was, oh, that means we can put value-added tax on fuel and power. That's given us the green light. How these things work. And then I was a strategy consultant. I worked for a number of companies, including British Airways, Virgin Atlantic. So I did various things. At the same time, I did quite a lot of think tank work. But it was my first book, Age of Global Warming, was published in 2013, and that was followed up 4 years later by the book with the title that you love, Green Tyranny, The Totalitarian Roots of the Climate Industrial Complex. And the big reveal in there was what political party was the first one in the world to have wind power in its election program?
Some 1500s Dutch party?
It has the initials NSDAP in the Reichstag elections in 1933.
The Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeitungspartei.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise known as the Nazis.
So, all right. It's getting sticky already in here. No, that's incredibly interesting. Now, I said half jokingly, but I'm going to ask it seriously. What is the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK? Because that is a really important position, right?
Yeah, it's the second most important position in the British government. He's the Secretary of the Treasury. But he has more power than a Treasury Secretary has in terms of the more limited power that Britain has, if you like. So he's responsible for raising taxes. He's responsible for allocating spending and for overall economic policy. So the Chancellor of the Exchequer typically is the second most powerful person in the British cabinet.
Very good.
And which Chancellor of the Exchequer? Was it Nigel Lawson?
It was Norman Lamont. I got to know Nigel Lawson, the great Nigel Lawson, subsequently. And he very kindly, I'll tell you the best thing that happened to happen, email I ever got on a Christmas Day. I sent him the proofs of my first book. And I got on Christmas Day, and I got this one-line email from Nigel Lawson, and he said, "You have written a brilliant book."
Nice.
You know, that was nice.
Yeah. When I think about all of the issues we have in this policy space and all of the bad advice so many politicians get, it gives me some hope to know that at some points along the line, some politicians get good advice. And I'm so hopeful that we can get back to that point at some time in the not so distant future, and we can start unwinding some of these things that you've been writing about for years.
Well, I'm very encouraged by the situation in the United States, because there is a debate in the United States about, particularly about energy policy, which there is none in Britain, there is none in Europe. The debate, insofar as there was a debate, it was over many years ago. And that the preconditions for doing all the net zero stuff is actually not having any debate. Because when there's debate, people, the obvious becomes plain, and it becomes clear you cannot do this stuff. You inflict such massive costs on ordinary people. You basically suck growth out of the economy. That's effectively what those, when you see those wind turbines spinning, mm-hmm. they're sucking the growth out of the economy. That's what you should think.
Well, that's what where I wanted to take this conversation, as I mentioned, is to educate folks on what's going on in other parts of the world, UK, for example, and sort of see the warning signs of what's going on there to help us better understand what we should not be doing here. So could you tell us what is going on in the UK? Give us some background and sort of where they are now and where things are headed.
You very kindly mentioned the report I've written, The Folly of Climate Leadership. And the reason I wrote it is as a warning to America. What broken Britain shows why Democrats' net zero policies would wreck America and destroy the American dream. And that is not hyperbole. To give you an idea, that Britain passed the Climate Change Act in 2008, the same year as the financial crisis. Since then, the British economy has had its worst performance in terms of growth and productivity since 1780. So, okay, 4 years after the Declaration of Independence, that span of time. the British economy has performed even better than the period since 2008. So it's been an absolutely, in economic terms, it's not a depression. It's not like the economy shrank by 30, it's essentially stagnated. So that means the tax burden rises, public sector austerity, there's no money to spend on anything. And into the bargain, households are being squeezed by a two-thirds increase in the price they're paying for electricity. Businesses are paying about three or four times the price per kilowatt hour as their American competitors are paying. So that is just driving British businesses out of world markets. It's closing down the steel industry. The petrochemical industry is basically withering away. Oil refinery, there's a big oil refinery at Grangemouth in Scotland that's being shuttered. Basically, you lose your industrial base.
So, Rupert, I have a question about that. I mean, isn't there a feedback loop where the consequences of this, once they start being felt, will trigger the debate in Europe that hasn't happened? Right now, I wrote recently about a European Commission report that came out in the middle of January that shows a really alarming report, even alarming for Americans, that shows industrial production in Europe in absolute free fall because of electricity prices being three times what they were in 2019. Capital investment has plummeted. The trade unions are sounding the alarm, and farmers are revolting in the streets. Isn't there a sort of feedback loop that will eventually get energy policy back on track in Europe?
The feedback loop isn't quite as mechanical as that, because what politicians, people aren't joining the dots. They're not joining the dots between farmers protesting in the streets of Brussels and in Germany and France because net zero policies actually are basically designed to wipe out agriculture in Europe. I mean, agriculture is a sector causing a lot of greenhouse gas emissions from farming, and the use of fertilizers and so forth. And so that sector has been targeted for net zero. And it's the Dutch farmers. There was the fall of the Dutch government in the recent general election there. But they're not joining the dots between that and net zero. So governments will say, well, they'll do a bung for farmers to keep them off the streets a bit. They will subsidize steelmaking. They'll say, we'll make steel out of green hydrogen or really expensive renewable electricity and so forth. And what your point, when you're looking at the decline in industrial production in Germany, which is very real, there's a tendency to think, oh, this is a recession. Actually, it's not a recession. It is structural. This is a structural contraction of the German economy. And Germany is the world's largest manufacturing export. I think it might be after China. But in terms of its percent of GDP, it's actually a bigger exporter than China. And its economy is being gutted by net zero policies. And you've got the traffic light coalition in Germany that just doesn't know how to respond to it.
Yeah, and so Rupert raises a great point, Jack, which is something that I have had my eye on since the Clean Power Plan that President Obama came out with in the United States, which is that Obama was very clever because he realized that the political consequences of raising a gas tax or a carbon tax, for example, would be so immediate that they threatened the electoral prospects of him and his allies. On the other hand, if he could develop a policy that deferred the political consequences or hid them in such a way that people didn't connect the dots, as we say on this side of the pond, then this would be a politically viable policy for them. And just so, this is what makes the EPA's electric vehicle mandates and power plant rules so insidious, is that by the time they are felt, the industry, the utilities, will have spent years trying to comply with them. And when that starts showing up in electricity prices, people won't know what to attribute it to. And even in Europe today, they blame the war on Russia, not net zero policies, for the stuff that's going on.
There's another important element to it as well that I think is worth mentioning, which is they're creating constituencies along the way. So they will subsidize the farmers or the wind makers or the solar panel factories, get those jobs up and running. Now you have a built-in constituency for the ongoing policy, because as soon as the policy changes, where the jobs are, the jobs that are left are all dependent on policy. And it really leads us down this road. And again, we keep using the word hyperbole. It's not hyperbolic. It leads us down this road of socialism. If by socialism we mean government ownership of the classic definition of the means of production, that's essentially what we're moving toward.
Yeah, I would caution, I'd be very careful about the green jobs myth, because first of all, in terms of blue collar work, you've got people working in the oil and gas industry. It's a very high value added industry. The way the incomes they generate are very good, whereas wind and solar, very low value added, much lower wages. The jobs that are, the people who are remunerated are in Wall Street, they're investors, they're consultants, they're lawyers, they're white collar. They're the white collar. But you're absolutely right, there is a climate industrial complex and they feed off all this stuff. And obviously government lobbyists are a key part of the climate industrial complex. The other thing that Mario talks about, the Obama EPA various regs that were designed to force coal off the grid, and a lot of those weren't CO2 regs, they were the MATs and so forth, there are various regulations, but what saved his bacon quite fortuitously was fracking, because fracking came along and mm-hmm. the cost of natural gas plunged. So driving coal down off the grid, the costs of doing that were hidden by the fall in natural gas prices from around 2009. That had nothing to do with Barack Obama and their policies. It has actually happened despite their policies rather than anything that they did to encourage
them. Yeah, that's the single best way to make a climate alarmist squirm, is to point out that the greatest reduction in carbon emissions that the world has ever seen is due to the fracking revolution in the United States.
Well, they're now going after natural gas. They're engaging in the same playbook that they used to get rid of coal, which is begin to demonize it, start to undermine the incentive to produce it by restricting exports. They're doing the same thing with natural gas now that they did with coal 15 years ago.
So Mike Bloomberg said he's going to spend $500 million on an AstroTurf campaign and legal action against to take coal off the grid and halve the amount of natural gas generation on the grid. But it's important to realize when we look at coal and natural gas, there was only 1 year since 2009 when natural gas was actually a cheaper fuel source than coal. Coal remains the cheapest way of generating electricity. It's also the most secure. It's really easy to store coal. You can see great mounds of it at power stations. It's much more expensive to store natural gas. It's quite difficult to store it. You can't store it for the length of time that you can with coal. So you get enormous, in terms of coal has a cost and reliability, a security advantage, way more than any other. I mean, nuclear is the only other one that comes close to it, but nuclear has its own difficulties, which is it's incredibly expensive to build new nuclear.
Thanks to government barriers, I would argue, but that's a different conversation for a different day. I would like to talk about coal for a minute, though, because I think that people forget about how important coal is, and even conservatives, I think, often fall into the verbal trap of inadvertently demonizing coal by thinking of coal outside the terms of being clean, and modern coal plants are extraordinarily clean.
Yeah, the ultra-supercritical coal-fired power stations, as you say, are incredibly clean. The emissions that come out of them are essentially carbon dioxide and water. And they're scrubbed clean, there are scrubbers and so forth, and they're thermally very, very efficient. But you can't, as you say, coal has been demonized in the West, that is. But what you have in the global South, will continue to use coal. It will continue to build coal-fired power stations. And there's a very simple reason for that. And that is that coal is the most abundantly widespread primary source of energy for electricity. And so for their own, India's got coal mines, South Africa's got coal mines, China's got coal mines. So they don't need to import. They don't have to import LNG. They don't have to rely on anyone else. And it is the cheapest source of fuel for electricity.
One might argue that there is an energy race going on, and the one that the United States should be attempting to beat China at is developing the ultra super super critical coal plants and be selling them to everyone, including in the United States.
But the really sad thing that's happening is that because it's virtually impossible to build new coal in the coal-fired power stations in the West, that technology is being developed elsewhere. So you're absolutely right. The race, in that respect, the race is over. And, you know, we're still at the start. We've just given up, and they're just powering on ahead.
And it's virtually impossible for international financing institutions to finance coal plants for developing nations who could otherwise really be lifted up out of poverty with this technology. So that further pushes China to the forefront of all of this.
That is absolutely right. So you have Western banks, particularly European banks, won't touch coal. The World Bank has a mandate, thanks to the Biden administration, against financing of coal-fired power stations. So where do they go? They go straight into the arms of China.
Yeah, and it's important to point out how incredibly regressive, and I would even say it's a borderline human rights violation to prohibit investment in coal for the developing world. There's another reason why these countries need coal besides the fact that it's cheaper than natural gas. People don't realize that, first of all, you basically don't really store natural gas. You have to pump it continuously. And in the United States, the transition from coal to natural gas has been made possible only because of the build-out of an extraordinarily sophisticated and far-flung and capital-intensive pipeline infrastructure that is a technology and a build-out of infrastructure that is simply beyond the possibilities of developing countries to do. So the upfront capital investment, the simplicity of being able to power an entire city from coal plants, it's much more simple for a poor country to do it than to do it from natural gas or nuclear. And so depriving them of coal is really depriving them of human flourishing at a basic level. It's a borderline. It's just Paul Johnson talked about the heartless tyranny of ideas. This is really a great example of that.
That is absolutely right. When you look at countries in sub-Saharan Africa, other than South Africa, which had its own special history, as it were, with apartheid, but sub-Saharan Africa, the problem there is that they burn too little coal. And similarly, Bangladesh and Pakistan, the amount of coal they burn per capita is in terms of ounces per capita, ounces per head. They are energy starved. And as Mario says, Western policy is to keep them that way.
And in large swaths of the United States as well. And it's equally, I would argue, equally as much a human rights violation keeping rural regions of the United States from accessing coal. In fact, it is that anti-coal policy within the United States that has caused many of these rural communities to become devastated, as well as in UK and in other Western countries.
Yeah, the other perverse thing is the northeast of the United States has insufficient gas pipeline infrastructure to power them through.
And they won't even allow them to build more.
And there was one year where, obviously before the Ukraine conflict, where Russian shipments of LNG were turning up in Boston Harbor. I think that's right, Mario.
That's right. And it's because New York has systematically abused its power under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act to block pipelines. We know one of the greatest sources of natural gas in the world is the Marcellus Shale that's underneath Pennsylvania and New York. Pennsylvania, of course, has developed those shale resources, but because New York is standing between Pennsylvania and New England, New York has blocked New England from getting these resources. And this stuff, just like the LNG, just like the ban on new LNG export licenses, is so counterproductive even from the climate alarmist point of view, because it forces, when you deprive people of natural gas, it forces them into coal. It forces them to burn stuff. I mean, and coal has three times the carbon emissions per unit of power output as natural gas.
Makes you think it might not be carbon dioxide emissions that they really are worried about. They must be worried about something else. If they cared about carbon dioxide emissions,
they wouldn't be closing nuclear power stations.
They wouldn't be doing a lot of things that they're doing, for sure. Now, I want to get into the report that you wrote.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the report. Two things that I want to make sure we get to before we close. I want to talk more about the report and what's in there, and what every American needs to learn from what Great Britain has done over the last number of years.
So what happened in 2008, I mentioned the Climate Change Act was passed by Parliament almost unanimously. There were five votes against it, right? So, and that was kind of the end of the matter. And what that led to was a huge increase in renewable wind and wind, particularly wind and some solar. I mean, solar, Britain is not the best place for solar for obvious reasons. It's cloudy, it's fairly northern, etc. So you've had a huge increase in renewables. And the problem with, and at the same time, we were part of the European Union's cap and trade scheme, ETS, which when we left after Brexit, we had our own cap and trade scheme. So you had two things happen to electricity prices. First of all, you had huge subsidies of wind and solar, which were paid by consumers. So there were consumer levies on so every kilowatt hour of electricity supplied to businesses and households, there will be an environmental levy that would be used to subsidize the wind and solar build out. And secondly, there was cap and trade. So you had a carbon tax on top of all the natural gas generation and electricity being generated from gas and coal. And the increasing amount of the carbon dioxide levies, meant that coal became very uneconomic. And so in 2014, the government was putting out of business coal-fired power stations, and the big six generators recorded a loss. They took write-downs and so forth on their thermal assets of £1.4 billion. Now, the effect of that was you had very, very high prices. Renewable wind and solar were getting very, very high prices for electricity thanks to all these government interventions. About double that. It was about over £100 per megawatt hour when they were selling their gas and coal generated electricity for around about £50 or £60 per megawatt hour, and they were making losses on that. So what you therefore had was a huge increase of high profitability, artificial profits of wind and solar, and you had a big fall off in the power station capacity needed to keep the lights on. So Britons have ended up paying more for their electricity for a grid that is less stable. That is basically the bargain of the so-called energy transition, what I call the energy regression, which is you pay more for a less reliable grid. Mm.
Mario, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah,
to that?
I wanted to say something else about the situation in Germany which goes back to a point you were making, Jack, about how you develop essentially a constituency for socialism is one of the really dangerous consequences of these policies. Right now, Germany is pumping 4% of GDP into cushioning the impact of electricity prices. 4% of GDP. That's before the pre-pandemic. That's close to the average federal budget deficit in terms of GDP. So in a single 2-year period, decades of German fiscal discipline. I mean, the last time the Germans did deficit spending was like before World War II. It's the most fiscally disciplined government on earth, practically, and decades of fiscal discipline has been wiped out in just 2 years as a result of this. And that 4% of GDP is pure socialism. I mean, that's pure unadulterated socialism. And these policies are going to be very difficult to unwind once they develop a constituency that depends on them.
Well, I think one of the scary aspects of all of this is that they are going to be difficult to unwind. It will take political courage to unwind them. I don't know of any politicians right now that have much political courage, so they will continue to use taxpayer money to try to mitigate the actual consequences of it, which will ultimately lead to a crash and a lot of pain for a lot of people. And that's where all of this is headed without making changes. And one of the things I think that we can learn from the work you've done, Rupert, is to look at where the UK and Europe is right now and say, look, we don't want to go there. We can alleviate a lot of our pain here by doing something different now and not headed further down this road.
Yeah, I mean, the issue for the United States is even more stark in a way than for Europe and for Britain, because the United States is a hydrocarbon energy superpower.
Yeah.
And going to net zero, you give all that up. You just basically say, we're going to trash that and we're going to depend on China for supplies of critical minerals to keep us powered with stuff that's far less efficient, far less productive than what we have underneath our own ground. So it is completely insane for the United States. But to Mario's point about the 4% of GDP being used to subsidize electricity costs, renewable power in Germany, that money doesn't come back. And you spend that on subsidizing renewable power, you don't have the money to look after yourself when the big Russian bear to your east is getting really quite grumpy and quite angry.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a big national security dimension here that Europeans can't do net zero and defend themselves at the same time.
And it not only takes away resources, but if those resources were to suddenly appear, you no longer have the infrastructure to do the things that you need to do. One of the things I wanted to dive into a little bit was using your economics and finance background. You described how net zero policies lead people to pay more for energy that's not worth it. The value's not there, and how all these companies are getting subsidies in different ways. What does that do over time, like to investment and finance and like it must have this ripple effect that gets larger and larger that compounds over time.
In 11 years, thanks to the so-called energy transition, the amount of electricity produced by 1 megawatt of generating capacity has declined by 28%. So you need more investment to produce less. That's essentially the story of the energy transition. And that is the fundamental factor driving up costs. And those ripple through the economy. You're making households have less money to spend on other things because they're paying more for energy. Businesses are less able to compete because they're suffering higher energy costs. And it's not just energy intensive industry like steel making or automotive manufacture. If you're a low margin, you're into hospitality services, your restaurant, whatever, energy costs, a big increase in energy costs wipes out your margin. So you basically, what you've got are stagnating, if you like, dying economies. And that's the thing, that's the trap that the United Kingdom and Europe have got themselves into. And as you rightly point out, in terms of the lack of courage of politicians, there's no politician say, we've got to cut the Gordian knot of net zero because this is destroying our economy.
So Rupert, do you attribute, another alarming fact that I read in the European Commission report is that Britain's had essentially a decade of zero growth. Do you attribute that to these policies? I mean, it's a lost generation of economic growth.
The stagnation since 2008, as I indicated earlier on, is unprecedented. I mean, the worst period of growth since 1780. And there have been two factors. One is the aftermath of the financial crisis and the policies adopted subsequently, particularly monetary policy and near zero interest rates and so forth. But unquestionably, net zero has a damaging effect on growth. And the growth is... Economic growth is propelled by productivity, improvements of productivity. As I've said about the decline in the capital efficiency of electricity generation, when you put more renewables on the grid, it has the opposite effect. It crushes productivity in the energy sector. And insofar as the energy sector is incredibly important to the rest of the economy, it has that knock-on effect throughout the economy. So, yes, one of the reasons why Britain has performed so badly are these very, very aggressive climate policies. And you're not going to turn around the economy until you get rid of them and you start having a serious dose of energy realism.
Yeah, I think what you just said was a really important point that people don't really understand, that the reason we have economic growth is because you're able to become more efficient over time. You're able to produce more with less. That increases productivity. That gives you more resources to invest otherwise into other endeavors, and that allows the economy to grow. That's where all economic growth comes from. And these green policies literally do the exact opposite. All of the things that have lifted millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty since the 1700s, all of the things that led to that, we're doing the opposite of. How anyone can conclude that it leads you anywhere than back literally centuries is beyond me. We have reams and reams of real life experience, of academic experience, of all the experience that you need to understand precisely how economies grow, and they are ignoring it. And people aren't calling him out on it. And I'll get to you in a moment, but just and that politicians, what they're doing is using taxpayer resources to mitigate the pain in the near term, to hide it from us, so that as we started this conversation, so that they're not held responsible for it. But to think that at some future point this doesn't all crash is just insane. It will crash, and it's going to be painful and difficult. Mario, I know you have something to say as well, so I'm going to shut up, then you both go.
Well, what I was going to say is, and it's great to hear. I mean, you're a great reminder, Rupert, that when Americans are feeling down, if they want to feel uplifted, they should just look at what's going on in other parts of the world, particularly Europe. Of course, the European Commission report was very alarming because if the European economy is not doing well, the American economy is not going to do well either, right? But one thing I did want to say that is a hopeful sign is that the competition with China for the 21st century is something that is focusing the attention of a lot of people in the United States and of the American government. And I think it's dawning on President Trump on his campaign a few months ago released a short video in which he committed to, as a national goal, if elected, to ensuring that America has the world's cheapest and most reliable electricity, precisely because we understand that it is necessary for manufacturing to compete against Chinese manufacturing in the long run.
Yeah, I would add to that that of Western world leaders for the last 30 years, there is only one leader who is an energy realist, who really gets that, and that is Donald Trump. And so in the Trump administration, there was a national security statement which talked about energy dominance and using America's energy abundance to further America's strategic aims through the world. That is absolutely right. It's that kind of thing that will you know, essentially save the West from what it's trying to do to itself.
Interestingly, I think there's another world leader who understands it, and it's the leader of China. Xi understands exactly, and he understands that they're able to exploit the net zero and green energy policies to do the exact opposite. They are, and it's interesting when you think about it, the free market version of energy allows America to expand its influence and its security. When the free energy markets allow us to take advantage of our domestic energy resources and those of our friends and to spread friendly molecules and electrons around the world, and that empowers us. The more you restrict that, that then creates the opportunity for the socialists, for the communists, to come in and do the exact same thing. It's literally different sides of the same exact coin. And we and the net zero policies are kicking the door open for China to do that.
That's absolutely right. And to take an example from the current administration and its pause on LNG exports, further exports, increased exports of LNG, Europe depends on those, on shipments of LNG. If they don't come from the United States, they come from Hamas harboring Qatar.
Yeah.
So, talking about Qatar, I thought it was, let's talk about the COP for a second. I thought it was a delicious irony that they were hosting the COP in what is arguably the world's most lavish and obscene display of oil wealth in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. There were actually lots of energy realists, it seemed, at the Climate Clown Show in Dubai, the COP, and they included the hosts of the COP, and they included India, and they included lots of countries that made it very clear that they are not going to sacrifice development to achieve climate goals. And so one question that I have for you is that in the decision document out of the COP committed to, you know, it was a soft commitment because of the opposition of United Arab Emirates and India and others, but they committed to transitioning away from fossil fuels. And the question that we had here was, well, what do they mean by that? Do they mean that they're going to reduce demand, which is the fairy tale of Fatih Birol, the executive director of the International Energy Agency, whereby, you know, the clean energy transition is so successful that people just lose interest in fossil fuels. And so we transition away from fossil fuels because demand just evaporates and oil drops to $30 a barrel. I don't know how renewables are supposed to be competitive against $30 a barrel oil. But there is another vision floating around the COP, which is the nightmare vision, right, of Stop Oil and Greta Thunberg, which is not demand-side reductions for fossil fuel, but rather supply-side reduction for fossil fuel, which is energy poverty. And Greta Thunberg says that one of her stump speech lines is that climate change is consigning millions of the world's poor is a death sentence for millions of the world's poor. What should be really obvious to everybody is that her policies would be a death sentence for millions of the world's poor. And so how many people actually believe in Fatih Birol's fairy tale of demand side reductions? And do people understand that what they're really going for is supply side reductions that are going to bring about energy poverty, and that in a climate of energy poverty, they will lack the political leverage that they need to complete the climate transition?
Well, I think, Mario, what you've described is exactly the big fissure in the world. The leaders of the Global South are energy realists. So when they sign that document, they know full well that hydrocarbon energy is here to stay, and it's absolutely vital for their ambitions for their countries to grow and to prosper. But it is Western leaders are deluded. Macron has talked about the IEA, Fatih Birol, I think, being the militant or the sword or whatever of the energy transition. They just pump out that the vision of renewables depressing the demand for because of their superiority. It's a fantasy. It's just really ridiculously stupid propaganda. But it is propaganda that Western leaders are very happy to parrot because they have nothing else. And Jack, to your point about economic growth and why we shouldn't be surprised that the green transition is so bad for economic growth, remember that the Greens are hostile to economic growth. Mm-hmm. They know what this is about. Greta Thunberg is hostile to economic growth. For 50 years, the Greens, since the limits to growth debates of the early 70s, the Greens have been arguing that economic growth destroys the planet. So don't be surprised that when we adopt their policies, we don't have any economic growth.
Well, that leads me to my final question that I want us to talk about. All right, we lose economic growth. We become slaves to China. People die. All these bad things happen. But at least
Chinese restaurants get better. I have noticed that.
No. At least this is all good for the environment. Like, the Greens have the environment at heart. Am I right? At least do I have that to hang my hat on?
Jack. Jack. Can I educate you?
Please educate you? Please.
You think that wind farms on hills...
That's what I'm told!
You think they're friendly to the environment?
That's what I'm told.
They don't kill bats and birds and insects on which the birds feed. Don't think they have any negative
impact? And I thought the oil that drips out of them isn't oil. It's
and you think that the
it's,
wind
it's
you
fair.
Think, you think the offshore wind uh-huh. off the coast of New Jersey, offshore wind turbines don't have any effect on
that's
right
what I
whales?
Thought. You're telling me that's not true. You're telling me
you think Jack. You think to save the village we have to destroy the village because that's what the environmentalists are doing.
That's why I've been paying all this taxpayer all my taxes.
And let me tell you another thing, uh-huh. Jack. The British
my EV is good for the environment, though, right?
What, that huge great lithium battery?
It's not good either.
And all that cobalt being mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yeah, it's Democratic Republic, right?
Yeah, Democratic. The People's by child labour. Uh-huh. And another thing, I just finish with this. The British Parliament passed the Climate Change Act to show climate leadership. That's why I called my report The Folly of Climate Leadership. And it was to show the rest of the world what could be done. Since then, Britain cut its carbon dioxide emissions by about 30%. 11 years of that hard work and the huge cost of reducing those emissions were wiped out in 140 days of rising emissions from the rest of the world. That is what we've ended up with. Uh-huh. That is the positive environmental impact.
Now I'm truly depressed because I thought at least we were getting a better environment out of all this.
But there's a more profound point even to make in response to the question you asked, Jack, which is And this is something that, you know, I spend a lot of time teaching university. I spend a lot of time talking to people that are very committed to staving off catastrophic climate change and so forth. And one thing that I try to impress upon them, and there are many, many examples of this, is that the climate transition is the clean energy transition is a very highly leveraged transaction. And it requires a degree of leverage that only energy abundance can provide. And it's very simple to explain by saying that when gasoline is $2 a gallon, people will listen to you on climate stuff, and they will say, well, okay, we've got energy abundance, let's salt some stuff away to stave off, you know, let's do some reasonable things to reduce carbon emissions. When gasoline is $4 or $5 a gallon, you have pushed fossil fuels to the top of their hierarchy of needs, and they don't want to talk to you about climate change then. And this is the lesson of the Yellow Vest protests in France. So I still think, I agree with Rupert that it's not a simple feedback loop, that the political consequences are essentially deferred and softened by the fact that people fail to connect the dots, or I guess join the dots, as they say, on the other side of the pond. But there is the simple fact that in conditions of energy poverty, the clean energy transition will be much more difficult than under conditions of energy abundance. And this is a point to really drive home to at least the more reasonable people on the other side.
There we have it, Mario. You got the last word. Rupert, thank you so much for being here today. Great conversation. I really appreciate it. Thank you to everyone who took some time out of your day to listen to the Power Hour. And if you enjoyed the podcast, tell your friends and families and colleagues to check us out. Email us at thepowerhour@heritage.org. Let me know what you're thinking. If you like the show, if you don't like the show, what we should talk about, what we shouldn't talk about. You got to email me and let me know. Now, before we end, Rupert, is there anything else you'd like to add? You have to add something because you were the guest and Mario took the last words. So now I'm giving it back to you.
I will add to Mario's last words, two words, interest rates. The energy transition so far has happened in a condition of very, very low interest rate, ultra low, unprecedented low interest rates. It needs trillions of dollars of capital. You can't do this in a higher interest rate world. It's really as simple as that.
Now, I want to know one thing. Do you have anything coming up? Where can people find you? Are you on X or where can people find out more?
I do a lot of writing for Real Clear Energy and Real Clear Politics. You can find my stuff there. The report is on Real Clear Energy.
We'll link to that.
Fantastic. And I should also say I'm writing my third book, Age of Error, which look forward to discussing with you.
We'll definitely have you on. Mario, where can people find you at?
Heritage.org.
All right. Heritage.org. And we'll leave it with there. Oh, John Pop, I almost forgot about you. My God.
Oh, come on.
What did you think of this whole thing?
I think this was a great discussion. And while the U.S. and U.K. and Europe are like Nero fiddling while Rome is burning, Xi and China get it and they're pulling our pants down.
Well, there you go. John Pop, if anyone deserves the final word, it's him. Remember, email us at thepowerhour@heritage.org. Rupert, thank you again for being a guest. Most importantly, thanks all of you all for listening. We'll see you next time.